Peter Vonzegezer has written, directed, and produced films. He's won a Penn Short Fiction Award, but he grew up in the shadow of his younger stepbrother, a prep school-educated violin prodigy also named Peter Vonzegezer. In his late teens, the younger Peter, nicknamed Little Peter, began to behave recklessly, lost touch with his family, and was eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia. In a memoir called The Looking Glass Brother, the older Peter writes about his childhood and how he reconnected with his stepbrother after a surprising phone call. It is published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Peter Vonzegezer to Ziegezer. I'm sorry, Peter.
It's okay.
I got it right the first three times. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's very pleasant to be here.
And this is not your first time at WNYC. You did a commentary just last year.
That's right, yeah. After in the wake of Newtown, I was very concerned that the NRA was trying to compile or getting the FBI to compile a list of the mentally ill, and I thought that was a little bit of a transgression in terms of civil liberties.
But do you think that you would have even had that concern if you hadn't had this personal experience?
No, I don't think so quite as much. I think that I think a lot in terms of what homeless people think about, and I think about what my brother, how my brother would like being on a national list of the mentally ill, and I don't think he would like that at all.
You begin the book with a telephone call from Little Peter in March 1995. Were you surprised to hear from him?
Yes, I was. Actually, I hadn't heard from him in probably a dozen years, and the stories I'd heard had been sort of outrageous and surreal, and I thought he'd just sort of disappeared into the American landscape.
Well, how did he sound?
He sounded sort of like a homeless person. His voice was very gruff and rough, and he was just not making a whole lot of sense.
Well, what was he asking? It often sounds suspicious when someone calls from out of the blue, even if it is somebody who you were once close to.
That's funny. I never thought of that. I never thought that he might be trying to loop me into some sort of money scheme or anything like that.
Was he asking you for anything?
I think he just wanted to see me and to connect. I think he was feeling so lonely. He had really become a serious full-time homeless person just a year or so before that. And I think he was still very much traumatized.
And what had he done before he had become homeless?
Well, I would say he was in that interim years that some people go into after college and before they settle down to a real job. And maybe some people viewed what he was doing as more serious than that. But he was traveling around the country, hitchhiking. For a while, he lived in a recording studio gymnasium in Moccasin, Montana, and just lived with a bunch of musicians and sort of was a bohemian.
Well, he had started showing signs of mental illness in high school, hadn't he? And then he tried to go to college?
I would say so. I mean, I feel very sorry for my father and stepmother in those years. I think they saw this brilliant kid, and I remember my stepmother saying when Peter would speak under his breath, she would say, "Oh, that's a sign of genius."
Well, he'd been a child prodigy on the violin, and so we often are willing to give them the benefit of the doubt.
I think so, and maybe a little too much so in his case. But he was doing quite well in school. He had a photographic memory. He was able to read a page and recite it back exactly as it was, and did very well in school. But got into trouble and was kicked out of boarding school and that sort of thing.
Well, you weren't living with them, were you? After your parents divorced, you stayed with your mother?
That's right. Yeah, I had that was my father's second family, and so that was sort of another divide between little Peter and me.
And then there is this oddity of the fact that you both have the same name. Now, his name was Peter something else.
Yes.
But did your father ever adopt him?
He didn't officially adopt him, and I don't really know what the legal standing of the name is, to tell you the truth. But Peter did at some point take the last name, and so there were two of us in the same family. We were often compared with each other.
Uh-huh.
I think
Well, he was the little genius.
Yeah, and I think I was sort of the deadbeat at that time. I was going through my teenage sort of hippie years and doing a lot of hitchhiking myself. I think if people had at that time said, which kid is going to end up homeless and which kid is going to end up, an artist in New York, I think they would have said I would have been the scruffy one.
Now, what about the name? There's another Von Ziegesar, a woman who has made a name for herself. Where does this name come from?
Well, it's German.
My
grandfather was a poet, actually, in Germany. And at the turn of the century, he ran afoul of his sort of military family. They were all officers in his family, and sort of in despair, I think after a failed love affair and maybe failure as a poet as well, he came to America on a boat, maybe 1908 or something like that.
A lot of people dropped the Vons.
Not in our family. We managed to hike all of those syllables through the centuries.
Now, okay, so your brother calls you, your stepbrother calls
yeah.
you. Where were you living at the time? You were married? Your wife was pregnant?
I had been living in Kansas City and had met my wife, and we moved back to New York, and my wife was pregnant, and I was writing for different magazines, sort of a freelancer, and my wife was in social work school. And so we were sort of in that sort of trajectory of first apartment, trying to kind of make it in New York, and here comes my stepbrother.
Well, you write that you and your wife tend to pick up strays, both of the animal and human variety. So is that what led you to be perhaps a bit more open to your troubled stepbrother than you might have been otherwise?
I think that's kind of an interesting question. I went to art school and art college, and I think I met a lot of people who had sort of non-standard brains, non-standard ways of seeing the world and dealing with the world, and a lot of people were dyslexic and so on. And so I think maybe more open than most to seeing someone be different.
But you didn't say, okay, come up to my apartment. You said, I'll meet you on the street.
Well, that's true. I think that, first of all, my wife was a social worker, and we had learned a few rules in Kansas City, mainly by breaking them. At one time, my wife worked in a battered women's shelter, and we allowed one of the women to live with us for a little while, and that was such a disaster. I realized that you have to, and even to save someone or help them, you have to save yourself first. It's like the sign on the plane where they say put the oxygen mask on yourself before you put it on your child. You have to save yourself. You can't give yourself over to somebody else's reality.
Okay, so you meet him on the street.
Yeah.
Did you recognize him immediately?
I did, although he was very distorted. I mean, in those two few years, he had really become a homeless person. He had become sort of doughy and fat. His face was scarred. His hands were gnarled. And it was a little scary. And, of course, he was wearing dirty clothes and sort of walking with a stoop.
And what had been the circumstances of your previous meeting with him a dozen years before?
Well, I think the last time I'd seen him, he had been a bicycle messenger in New York, and he had forgotten to deliver some negatives that someone had taken of Tommy Tune. And so I get a call all of a sudden from this producer who's just steaming, and he thinks that I'm my stepbrother, which happens quite a bit since we have the same unusual name. And he said, I'd like to wrap my hands around his neck. And I said, well, listen, he's got a lot of thinking to do, but I'll get you the negatives. And so I called up my stepbrother and found him and got him to deliver these. He had just gone home to Connecticut without delivering. Forgotten, I guess.
My guest is Peter Von Ziegesar. His memoir, The Looking Glass Brother, published by St. Martin's Press. Let's talk about that title for a second. Looking Glass Obviously, you see a mirror image of yourself. How much of yourself did you see mirrored in Little Peter?
I think I identify with him a little too much sometimes. I in my life have sort of felt like an outcast quite often, and I could understand his feeling like an outcast. So I think that in some ways I did feel as though he was a mirror of me. And I also felt in the Alice in Wonderland point of view that he had gone through the looking glass into another world that was a mirror world of ours.
A little more surreal than our world.
A little more surreal and very strange. And, of course, I'd lived in New York quite a bit, so to see homeless people all around you all the time, you can't help but wonder, what is their world like? Are they people, too? Are they just sort of urban fauna? And I think Peter sort of opened the door into seeing what it was like as a person.
So did you invite him to stay with you? Your wife was pregnant. That would put a little stress on the situation.
I brought him home that night, and he took a bath, and we hung out with him a little bit, and then we took him out to dinner in Chinatown. He had this sort of thing about Asian people. Of course, my wife is Asian as well, but he felt that some sort of healing process could happen if we went to Chinatown. So we were there, and at that point, after dinner, I had to say, Peter, you can't live with us. You can't come home with us. And he flat out asked me if it would be possible. And I said, no, I'm sorry. You know, you're a street person. My wife is pregnant. The doorman wouldn't understand in our building. I don't think it could work out. And so I just gave him a subway token and $20 and said goodbye. It was one of the saddest departures I've ever been involved in.
But it didn't end your contact.
No, it didn't.
In fact, you tried to help him produce a movie about his life?
Well, I have a friend named Jim Syme, who's a great photographer, and he and I and Little Peter at one time tried to make a documentary film about Peter and about me, and I envisioned it as sort of a theater of the absurd piece where we would all play out our lives and pass the camera back and forth. I mean, this is the art training in me. I for some reason think of art as being the only way to heal oneself, and so I took this as a process and also as a way to dealing with Peter. I mean, Peter likes to hang out in the street and I don't, so how can I spend time with him except by doing art?
But you have made films since. You made Prom Night in Kansas City with your wife Holly Lee. That was about 11 years ago.
That's right, yeah.
And other films along with writing?
Well, there was the film that I shot quite a bit of with Little Peter. We showed that around to HBO and a bunch of other places, and it never quite took off the ground. I think I got more involved in writing at that point, and the expense the time and everything and putting another movie together just seemed too daunting at that point.
Now, you saw Peter at the onset of the schizophrenia, and you said that there were clues, although his mother explained them simply as being part of his genius. Have you done any research into why people in their late teens and early 20s sometimes become schizophrenic?
No, I don't, and there's a lot of mystery surrounding that, and even in Peter's case, there's some mystery surrounding his diagnosis. Perhaps he's more of an Asperger's case than schizophrenic.
Well, after he reconnected with you, Little Peter continued to see his childhood psychiatrist, the same doctor who had committed him when he had dropped out of school. You sat in on one of the therapy sessions, and you were kind of upset by the way the therapist treated your brother?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I mean, everything was new to me. I think that if he had had a chance to see my stepbrother on a more regular basis, something could have come out of it. But it seemed just another sort of absurd collision between two different cultures when I viewed that particular interview. But there were more sessions with that psychiatrist that were quite helpful, I think.
Well, what does Little Peter say about his experiences with the authorities?
Well, he thinks the authorities have a way of looking directly into his brain. So his view of the world is quite surreal. I think he at various points can feel persecuted and as though people are watching him. One of the reasons he spends so much time outdoors is simply because when he's in a hotel room or someplace, he starts getting very paranoid. He starts thinking people are looking into his thoughts and stuff. And luckily, he's an outdoorsman and a very strong, physically able person. So he spends a lot of time outside.
And you remain in contact with him?
I do. He calls me at least once a month. It's good to hear from him.
And is he able to cope these days? Is he living outdoors?
Living outdoors, living under a bridge. He's in Pueblo, Colorado. The other day he called me. He was on a road bicycle trip on a $20 bike that he found somewhere between Denver and Idaho. I mean, an 800-mile trip with no money, just food he picked up along the way. He's incredibly strong, a real athlete.
And I'm sure you worry about him still. But you still wouldn't take him in.
No, I wouldn't. I think that would be too destructive. He's hard to be with. He takes a lot of energy out of you. I enjoy seeing him, but only in short amounts. I saw him in Santa Fe quite recently.
Peter von Ziegesar has written for Double Take, the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine, Outside Art in America. His memoir, The Looking Glass Brother, is published by St. Martin's Press.
Thank you very much. It's been very pleasant.